my friends. This is Mickey Desai, and this is also The Thing About Cars. Around the table today, we have a full house. Dawn, are you there?
I am here.
Becca?
Hello.
And Ben?
Hey, hey.
And let's start off our episode with a moment of Grand Trivia Auto. We may actually do two questions because the first question I have is just so simple. It's just almost pedestrianly simple. So the question is simply, what is the name of the hood where the air scoops stick out of the top through the hole? Is it called a shaker? Is it called cowl induction, a bonnet, or a ram air vent? And you guys want to go ahead and guess, because I just think that one's pathetically simple.
Wait, you said on the hood?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
On the hood where the air scoops stick out of the hole through the hood.
Like out in the middle of the thing, right?
Yeah, in the middle of the thing.
Not exactly. Above the hood, but in the hood, yes.
In the hood, yeah. So
there's shaker, cow what?
Cowl induction.
Cowl is a hard word for a southerner, by the way. C-O-W-L. It's one of those that we can mangle. So you have to sit there and go cowl when just you're
say,
southern.
Just say cow and put an L on the end of it.
Oh. It's tough to stick that extra syllable in there, isn't it?
The southern thing mangles it, yeah.
So shaker, is it a shaker hood? Is it a cowl induction? Is it a bonnet, or is it a ram air vent?
Should we all just throw it out there, or are we going to
out there, because now we'll just do two questions this time.
Shaker.
Shaker, what do you guys think?
I just like pronouncing cowl induction. that's a stumper for me. I'm going to say cowl.
Ben, what do you think?
Well, I would go with shaker if the technicality matches.
Right. Well, it is shaker. The term was coined by Chrysler. Once upon a time, it was called the shaker hood, and some official Chrysler literature referred to this popular hood style as the incredible quivering exposed cold air grabber.
The reason why I was making the distinction with in the hood, because the cowl is, what do you want to say, above the hood, beyond the hood?
Right.
It's right there at the hood, but not in the hood. So
that's okay.
That's why I was making that distinction of the location, because your cowl is basically where your windshield wipers come out of.
Out. Mm-hmm.
Right. So, yeah.
Okay. I wasn't visioning that. So interesting.
Okay. So the question we are going to ask, the official one that we'll answer at the end of the episode is what is the most stolen car in America? And that is with data updated so far for 2020. And, I'm not going to name any choices for this one because there are not that many things to choose from. But I don't know. You want to turn that one into a multiple choice? Should I do that for you guys? You just want to make some guesses at the end of the show?
Why don't we just make random guesses? It's always multiple choice.
All right, let's do that. So we'll come back to that at the end of the show. What is the currently most stolen car in America? On our agenda for today, we've got a wide variety of things. Let's start with an idea that Don has in decades of cars, and Don already has dibs on a particular decade. Don, can you set us right on this?
Absolutely. I was just really perseverating over why I love cars so much. And
perseverating.
Yes, perseverating. It's a technical term, folks out there. Look it up.
Yes, it is.
I was just thinking, why is it that I just love cars. And then I started thinking, well, I was born in the 60s. My parents had a 1964 Corvette, Honduras Red. My dad was stationed in D.C. We would drive back to McKeesport, which was on the south side of Pittsburgh, almost every weekend, about a three-hour drive. And I just love cars. So I started research in the 60s and realized that was the decade where a lot of things were happening. A lot of changes were happening. Cars were getting more streamlined, smaller, where they were going from steel to aluminum. And the muscle car came in. So there's just a lot every decade or every year of that decade. Something was really happening. And some of the things that I actually did some research on was one of the themes of that year, the 1966 cars, which is the year I was born, was that there was a lot of new standards because of safety. And they were, putting, for the first time, notifying car buyers of defects. They were anchoring, shoulder and seat belts. They were doing recessed control knobs. I mean, just tons and tons of things to the flashers and the lights and the safety of the car. So, you know, it's interesting that my first thing kind of experience was cars that were safer, and your mom didn't just say, you know, throw her hand out and hold you when she hit a stop. So I think the cars of the 60s are really great. One of my favorites that I'm looking at right now is a Jaguar, and it's the one with the really long nose, the E-Type. And supposedly Enzo Ferrari said it was the most beautiful car he'd ever seen. So I'll stop there. I've got other things to talk about, but chime in, guys.
Yeah, I think Ben might need a moment on.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, I need to comment about that noise that just came from Ben's direction.
Yeah, well, you know, Enzo was not alone in that opinion. A lot of people agreed with him, and a lot still do.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it looks kind of odd by certain modern standards, but yeah, I think there was a certain amount of elegance there that we haven't seen since.
And it was just about the fastest thing off the dealer's showroom floor in its day, too. It was the thing that everybody had to have. It was just the car that, you know, turned the whole market on its ear.
And that's so funny because I'm just looking at it and saying, gosh, that is a beautiful vehicle. I'm wondering if it has one of those shaker hoods because it has the little vents right up on the top of the hood.
No, it's just got a little bulge, which is just there for looks because that bulge is in the center and it's narrower than the cam covers underneath it.
Oh, okay. Got it. Well, it is a pretty car and it...
And it's a good handler. You know, they produced it for 13 or 14 years. It survived into the 70s.
Wow. In that same look, too. And yeah, it's quite a gorgeous car. So, go ahead.
I was going to say, somewhere around 70 or 71, I could be way off on this year, but somewhere in there, they switched from an inline six to a V12. Rumor has it that they did that because Lotus kept beating them in acceleration tests with their little fiberglass four-cylinder kit cars. But no, the XKE, as it was also known, was just so great on so many fronts. It really just hit the ball not only out of the park, it hit it out of the neighborhood, it hit it out of the district, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then when you look at the front grille, you know, it's like got that oval shape. You're seeing a lot of grills this 2021 and 2020 come out with these interesting front grills on it. So I wonder if there's some homage back to those, especially the muscle cars. So
yeah, I don't know. They didn't change it much. They changed the size of it. The grill became larger with the 12 because it needed more cooling air, but it was still a little oval on the front end.
Mm-hmm. I've never really thought of correlating the Jaguar with muscle cars.
Well, no, I was making a leap in terms of.
Well, I was trying to put those two thoughts together in my head. It's like, sports car, perhaps.
Yeah, but it's interesting. They were both having the heyday at that time. You know, the muscle cars and these sleek looking cars, even the Ferrari and the Ford GT40. It might have been a bit more chunkier than that Jaguar, but still really sleek looking.
Yeah, and it was powerful too. The XK type six cylinder that it started with is a really good engine. It was not the first car to use it, nor the last. They've made versions of it for decades, and as inline sixes go, it's really a pretty unbeatable engine. It's powerful and torquey. It was about as muscular an engine as Britain made in those days. And the 12 that replaced it was a 5-liter unit, I believe, in most of its incarnations, which is the same displacement as the American V8s. And those 12-cylinder Jaguar engines have been known to be used in drag racers. You can find on YouTube. and they scream, too.
Wow. So, which actually does, that makes it some interesting comparisons then to muscle cars.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Of course, the E-Type would outhandle most of the muscle cars. I think about everything but the Corvette would, you know.
Yeah.
That's why you have to have the distinction between the muscle cars and the sports cars. They're not meant to compete. One is meant to handle. One is meant to go straight.
Right. So So Dawn, are you suggesting we each take a decade, or should we like start with our birth years, or what?
It would be kind of cool to do that. I think that sometimes I just think we unknowingly are shaped by, you know, the time that we're born in, and you know, we don't want to be stereotyped or categorized, but I do think there's some cool things cars from years that we were born.
Okay, So let's start with that. Let's start with each year that we were born, and then if we pick a decade later, I think I know which decade I would want.
Well, see, that's what I was mulling in my head. I was born in the 70s, but I'm a child of the 80s. So it was like, which would I rather take? And where I love the 80s, you know, K cars weren't all that awesome.
I'll take the 80s. I love the 80s. I think my wife and I in particular would have a good time talking about 80s cars.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, she's giggling in the background. I can sort of almost hear her. But yeah, let's do that. So we'll discuss decades offline then and figure out which decades we want. And in the meantime, I have, I don't know, I guess we do take our birth years, right? So
I'll stick with 66 for a little while, and then I can go up or down a year since I seem to be the elder of the group.
Well, yeah, I don't know if anything happened in 19, you know, I don't know if anything exciting happened in the world of automotive history in 1969, but I'm definitely going to look into it. So,
yeah, cool.
Yeah. All right. We'll come back to that then with stuff in a later episode. Becca, you said that there was a recall announced recently.
Yes, I had something in the news pop-ups come across couple of days ago that there's been a rather large recall for Kia and Hyundai. And I was trying to see if I can make a list for the specific vehicles. 2013 through 2015 Optimas, 2014 and 2015 Sorentos, 2013 to 2015 Santa Fe's. I don't see any other specifically mentioned, but these vehicles are experiencing a brake fluid leak, and this leak could cause a short that starts fires.
Ooh, that's bad.
That is bad. They're not reporting any injuries or fatalities currently. They're just saying, well, it's not showing up in the documents that there were any injuries or fatalities.
But brake fluid is not nice to other components, and I think people don't realize that that's the case.
Although, but it is saying there was an earlier report that they're separating that says, yeah, there was 3,100 fires and 103 injuries.
Yeah.
Wow, so, over 3,000.
Yeah, so there's been a lot. So if you own one of these vehicles or know somebody who owns one, you might want to just check to see if they're part of the recall. And because that's kind of a scary one. Fires in a car, you know.
How many? That's a pretty popular.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it encompasses quite a few cars. So.
Well, I wonder how they're going to fix it. I mean, are they just re-engineering a part and putting that new part in? I guess that's the way to do it.
Probably.
Well, they're saying it's inside the hydraulic control unit for the anti-lock brakes. So right. I'm assuming they have a replacement part.
Yeah.
Maybe there are some, what do you call them, the steel lines instead of plastic or what have you they've got on now, possibly. I don't have that much information. I don't know what their fix is going to be. I'm assuming they've got something already devised, though.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm sure they do. Well, thank you for the update. Hopefully people can avoid any trouble.
I feel like I should have been the news desk there. I need one of those
exactly.
News sounds.
Breaking.
This just did.
Maybe that's your segment, Becca. Maybe that's the segment you've got from now on. You know, now the news desk with Becca. I'm not kidding. I'm only half joking about that. Maybe
No, I know.
Yeah. Brought to you by Becca.
Right.
News at 11.
News at 11.
We're going to our correspondent in the field. Right. Yes, Becca, can you hear us? Yes, I can hear you.
Nice.
Ben, you've got some big news for us, Ben.
Yes, I have a major Lotus update.
Yes.
Well, in the last few weeks, the short version is it has turned a mile or more under its own power.
Wow.
Yeah, a few weeks ago, well, you know, to back up a little bit, a few months ago, I was at the point where I was ready to start up the engine and, you know, test that out a bit. And so I did. It started right up pretty much, and it ran nicely. The only thing problem was it leaked a lot of oil when it ran. This is not good.
Oh.
So, yeah, so I had to tear a lot of the engine apart again. Well, I shouldn't say again. I hadn't torn it apart in the first place. But, yeah, with all that leakage, it's not a good thing. And the way this engine's constructed, it's got a, you know, water pump / front cover on the front of the block. Mm-hmm. And the cylinder head and the oil sump or pan, as we Yanks like to call it, both overlap that front cover. So it all has to come apart to deal with any, you know, plate that screws to the front of the block and then a cover that screws over that. The timing chain is in between them and the water pump is integrated into that front cover. So a lot of places where you can have leakage happen. So I took it all apart, resealed, regasketed everything. Had a lot of interesting adventures with the head itself, a lot of valve train issues and valve clearances and things like that. Broke off a cam cover stud below the surface of the head at one point. You all may recall some of these misadventures, but it finally went all back together. And a few weeks ago, I started it up. It ran very nicely in the driveway a few times for several minutes apiece, but I couldn't go out and drive because there was no seat and no steering wheel inside.
Wow.
Right. You talk about, you know, that kind of like, oh, man, if only. So, you know, by the following weekend, I got that taken care of. I put in a seat. I put in the steering wheel and a shift knob, too.
Yes. That might be useful. Yes.
Possibly.
Right. And, you know, started out with a little trepidation because, you know, my house sits about, 12 or 15 feet above street level, probably. Got a little bit of steepness in the driveway. So I'm saying to myself, okay, do you want to just charge down the driveway and risk not being able to get back up? You know, because I really don't know how it's going to run.
Right.
Out on, you know, under power out on the street. So I did, you know, a bunch of 88 point turns in the garage apron at the top there just to make sure the brakes worked, first of all.
Right.
I mean, they should in theory have. The pedal was firm, but, you know, you don't really know till they're turning and under load.
Right.
That was all good. So then I nosed down the driveway a little bit, let it, you know, creep down and then hit reverse back up a little bit and everything seemed good. So I said, okay, go for it. Go down into the cul-de-sac and do a few little circles and figure eights and then start going up and down the street. Everything's nice. It's shifting okay, except the clutch master cylinder sticks a little bit sometimes. I have to pump the clutch a little bit to get it to work because of that. But that may loosen up over time. We'll see.
Right.
And so that all seemed pretty good. Took it back up and put it away. And then the next morning, I put in a seatbelt. Very important.
Very important.
Ah, because those 1965 requirements. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a 70 model. Yeah, right. This is a 70 model, so it did come with them. I just didn't have one in at the time.
Yeah.
But I put one in. Nice one, too. I had them, you know, re-webbed. And had the buckles re-chromed and all that stuff, so they're pretty nice. Put a seatbelt in and got out in the surrounding area. First, I went to the gas station because it only had about 2 gallons in it, and I wanted to see if anything would leak around the fuel level sender gasket. So, you know, I trickle in some fuel, watching, you know, where that gasket is. Okay, everything's good. It gets about 3/4 full. And so the gasket is good, and you know that would also allow me to know whether any fuel would slosh out of the filler on hard corners. Mm-hmm. The way this car is designed, the filler is on the left rear fender. It's one of those Monza-style ones, a little button, and the thing hinges open. And people always complained that when they took hard right-handers, a little fuel would, you know, get sloshed up the neck and leak out and run down on their paintwork. And there's a modification for that that uses the anti-splashback valve from the filler of all things, a Mazda Miata.
I was going to say, isn't there a one-way valve that gets put in the line somewhere?
Not originally, but I added this one.
Uh-huh.
And I also put a new gasket in the cap, and it all held. Nothing leaked out. So I drove around, probably did about 10 miles, you know, around, you know, nearby neighborhoods. It's got up to about 60 on the, you know, major divided road near the neighborhood for about a minute. But other than that, kept it down to, you know, 40, 45-ish on those neighborhood roads. And it was all very good. It handled nicely. Probably needs a little front-end alignment work yet. There's a lot of things that need tweaking. But everything seemed pretty satisfactory. And then I just have to be pointed back toward home and close to home when I come to a red light and I see some smoke coming from the right front corner.
Yep.
Like oh, that's not good. I've got an extinguisher with me, but there's no flame visible anywhere. I don't have a bonnet on the thing still because of the amount of work I'm doing, you know, in the front end. I didn't see any, you know, any smoke coming from directly around the engine. It seemed to be coming out of the wheel well. Like, okay, well, probably got a little toasty on one of the brakes or something. So better head for home. Get home, and I find out that, sure enough, the right front caliper has sprung a leak. Mm. Not a major leak, but it only takes a few drops to make a mess of smoke. You know, we were talking about brake fluid earlier. That's one of its qualities. It will smoke.
Right.
But I got home without incident, pulled back in the garage. I've now got the front brakes apart, and I made a discovery at that point that the two front calipers are not the same.
Huh.
There's an early type and a late type, and the only real difference is the way that the rubber seals are constructed.
So someone had done a job that, and they didn't match your two front calipers?
Yeah, well, my first thought was that one of them must have been changed by a previous owner, but, you know, discussing this in the forums and talking with one of the parts suppliers I use, it is entirely possible that the factory did it.
Huh.
Because, well, for a couple of reasons. One, because this car was made during a transitional era at Lotus where, you know, the model was being refreshed a little bit. A few features were being changed. And so they may have had both types of caliper in stock at the time. And another annoying thing about Lotus is being that it was, in those days, kind of a shoestring company. A lot of times they made do with whatever they could get their hands on.
Mm-hmm.
The previous one that I owned was an 80s model, and it had an unusual carpet color in it. And the factory archivist told me that there are 10 cars with that color of carpet, and the leading theory as to why, because they never documented things very well either.
Right.
The leading theory as to why they did that was because the correct carpet had run out and was temporarily unavailable, and so they just got what they could.
That's hilarious.
But that's the theory with these brakes. The prevailing opinion seems to be, yeah, the factory could well have mismatched them. And again, it's not a big deal. It's basically the same size piston, the same design caliper, the same pads. The difference is just the way the dust seal, you know, fits around the piston. But this means that if I buy rebuild kits, I've got to buy two different kits. The kits come with enough to do both calipers. I've got to buy enough to do two of the one kind and two of the other kind with some parts left over. Which means, well, you know, how long will they last on the shelf before the rubber, you know, dries up and hardens? Well, then again, I might be able to extend that by taking the leftover bits and putting them in one of those vacuum sealer bags. We happen to have one of those food sealers in our kitchen, so
maybe well, wait a minute. Why can't you just upgrade the thing and put on?
Well, that's where I was going
to
go.
I'm getting to that.
Comparable. Oh,
okay. Okay.
Right. I'm getting to that. So. I could either buy a old style caliper for the right side or a new style caliper for the left side to have a matching setup. And I'm running into trouble there. There's one supplier in the United States who has old core calipers in stock, and he's got, you know, multiple units of exactly what I already have rather than the opposite, which is what I need.
Right, right.
All he's got for lefts are old style, and all he's got for rights are the later style.
That's too funny.
There are UK suppliers who can help me out here. The problem is that there are two options, actually. There's, you know, reconditioned old ones, and there's new ones, and I have yet to hear anything say anything good about the new ones. You know, they're produced probably in the Far East or something. You know, they're a pattern part, and they're not generally looked upon well. Reconditioned old ones are available from some of the UK suppliers. The problem is I have to exchange one of my old ones. So first the question is, can I exchange one type for the other in that deal? Will it mess their inventory system up if I do? But then the bigger issue is it costs a lot if you're a private individual to ship things from here to England.
Yeah.
I know this because, and it's not true the opposite direction. I, you know, I've gotten things shipped from Britain for both my car and for motorcycles I used to have for really reasonable, quick and reasonable.
Yeah.
But I had a replacement wiring kit for the doors of the Lotus that I turned out I didn't need. And somebody in England wanted to buy it from me, and I tried to ship it to him, and you would not believe, like a little flat square plastic paper or cardboard box, like you put a little tape reel in or something, half an inch thick and probably 5 inches on a side with some coiled up wire inside it, 5 ounces. The best quote I got to send that to England was about $90.
Wow.
So, you know, I don't even want to think about what a 12 or 15 pound brake caliper is going to cost to send over there. So exchanging for a rebuilt unit from overseas is not really an option at this point.
That's a shame.
So I just have to keep trolling the ads and see if I can find one that matches, you know, one of the ones I've got. I don't know how long my patience is going to run on that. Maybe I'll just buy the two different rebuild kits and go with it, and then just, you know, make the conversion to a matching caliper a long-term project.
What about go ahead, Don.
I was going to say, what about emailing some of those guys like Counting Cars or something, where they've got really incredible machine shops and might have a network of supplies?
I'm probably already networked with the Best Bet for, you know, finding something.
Yeah, I imagine Ben's already plugged into the gotcha. Lotus parts community pretty well.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a good idea, but
right, it's a pretty specific range here for these things.
But I'm surprised that it costs so much to get stuff over there. Like, what about parcel post, or what about even a European like DHL?
With that little 5-ounce wiring thing, I checked with DHL.
Oh, well, then just find somebody that's flying over and have them stick it underneath. And then find somebody to mule it back for you.
Exactly. There you go. Yeah.
You need a brake caliper mule, Ben.
Yeah.
Well, I'm encouraged about the update. I hope that we can share some video of the car moving around in the near future whenever you're ready.
Sure, I've got some short clips that Jen shot from the front porch, you know, looking way down the yard, so the car looks about the size of an ant in these videos, but, you know, little shots of me circling around in the cul-de-sac.
And it's, I saw that one, and it sounds pretty good. I was like, wow, you can actually hear it. So
can't hear much, but no. Once I've got it pretty reliably running, I'm going to try to figure out how I can do some onboard video. I don't want to have to buy a special camera just to do that, but I also can't hold my phone while I'm driving.
Well, what we do is you get you on the road, and we'll get the Honda, except we'll take the passenger door off the Honda.
Oh, there you go.
And then we'll hang Becca out the side of the car with the camera, and that way she can get down low near the ground and get some like ground shots of the Lotus.
Are you?
Yeah.
Man, I'm glad they volunteered you, Becca.
Right?
You know what we could do? Yeah, we do have a friend who works at a TV station.
Oh, that's true. Okay.
I wonder if she could steal one of their, you know, mobile units and
let's go talk to her. I do have a GoPro. I have an older GoPro we could use, but
get somebody with a minivan with a sliding door, you know.
Or
have a camera inside that.
Or why don't you just use mounts that attach to a car? I actually have some interesting suction cups that adhere to the outside of a vehicle to hold cameras and things.
Yeah, I still have to buy it. I don't want to spend a whole lot of money just to make a video of me driving.
No, if we can use my older GoPro, we can use that, and I've got a ton of mounts for it. So we can.
Oh, I didn't know you had that. Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome. It,
so. Even a selfie stick out the window.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Exactly. So, all right, very cool. So let's wrap this episode by answering our Grand Trivia Auto question. The question was, what is the most stolen car in America? And this is the list that I have has been updated with 2020 information so far. So what do you guys think? What's the most stolen car in America? Ben, you want to get us started?
Oh, my just sort of gut instinct guess would be the Honda Odyssey.
Honda Odyssey. Don, what do you think?
Well, I used to be the Jetta. The Volkswagen Jetta was a very popularly stolen car. So, but now in the time of COVID, it seems like it would be a much more common vehicle. But maybe a Volkswagen. I'm not sure if it's just the Jetta, but Volkswagens are pretty popular.
What do you think, Becca?
Well, I'm thinking along the same lines, kind of like Dawn is. The Honda Civic used to always make the top of the charts, but it was because the Civic, there were so many on the road, it was commonly stolen for parts. So that's the path that I'm heading down as well. I'm trying to decide which car I think is in abundance like that. There's also other cars that are primarily stolen for joyrides. I know my insurance company used to send me letters all the time about how commonly Mustangs were stolen, just to really scare me, I guess. I don't know. I think I'm leaning towards a BMW, perhaps. And I mean, mostly for parts, though.
Right. So I'm going to read this list backwards here from 10 going up to 1. This is from Insurify.com, the top 10 stolen cars updated with 2020 data. Number 10 on the list is the Jeep Cherokee / Grand Cherokee, with the model year most stolen being the year 2000 model year. Number 9 is the Dodge pickup, a full-size pickup, 2001 being the most common model year stolen. Number 8, GMC pickup. Number 7, Toyota Corolla. Number 6, Nissan Altima. Number 5, Toyota Camry. Number 4, a full-size Chevy pickup. Number 3, a full-size Ford pickup. I think we've covered that twice, but this must be a different. But here's the top 2 and the top 1. Number 2 is the Honda Accord, with the model year most stolen being 1997. And the number 1 most stolen car so far this year is the Honda Civic.
So it is still the Honda Civic.
Yeah.
I wasn't thinking there were quite as many on the road as there used to be, because it used to be they were everywhere.
So the number of thefts of the Honda Civic, about 38,400 thefts. The most stolen model year is the year 2000. And so about 0.5% of...
I'm shocked at some of those older ones that came up. Like, you know, are there enough 20-year-old Jeeps out there to make the theft statistics? I mean...
there's a ton of old Jeeps out there.
I don't see them very much.
Well, you know, right, they're calculating this based on pure numbers, not on percentage produced.
Right.
That's correct. Okay. Just raw numbers. And the write-up here says, Insurify.com says, even though the Cherokee is the only SUV to rank among the 10 most stolen vehicles, it's not hard to see why thieves target this car. Not only has the Jeep Cherokee been popular for decades, but like many of the other vehicles on this list, this durable vehicle is also distinguished for its longevity. If maintained properly, this car can reportedly last well over 300,000 miles. So they're giving it a production thumbs up.
Mm-hmm. Talk about old Cherokees here.
Yeah.
Oh, they're such pieces of junk.
That's what I always thought, but that's not what these people are saying.
Okay.
And Cherokees are not Grand Cherokees.
Right. Jeep Cherokee / Grand Cherokee. It says both, Becca.
Right. I'm just saying they are two different.
Yep.
Makes so. Or models. Sorry.
Yep. Yep. So yeah, there you have it. That's our top 10 list for 2020 so far. That's it. That's all we've got today. Let's wrap the episode. And why am I blanking on how to wrap an episode? Don, take us out, would you?
Thank you for joining us today with The Thing About Cars.
Yes. Thanks as always for joining us. Hope you and yours are all staying safe out there. We'll see you with another episode in about a week. Take care, you guys.
Bye.
Thank you for listening. This has been The Thing About Cars. We'll see you on the road. We'll be right back.